We want information.
I will not be pushed.
Who are you?
Filed. Stamped.
The new number two.
Index.
Who is number one?
Briefed. Debriefed.
You are number six.
You are a lying ignoramus.
Or numbered.
I am not a number.
My life is my own.
I am a free man.
You're making this stuff up.
Now, live from the Lion, 90.7 FM, Radio Free Penn State.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Radio Free Penn State on the Line, 90.7 FM, your Friday freaky edition of Radio Free Penn State. Finally getting off the ground. This is your friendly neighborhood annihilator in the house. We got a special edition of Radio Free Penn State for everybody today. No other panelists, no other co-hosts, no other guests. What we're going to do for everybody is we are going to play for you a candid discussion between yours truly and the dean of the Penn State Schreyer Honors College, Dean Christian Brady, who we interviewed for InsideAcademia.tv about a couple weeks ago. We aired it. We're going to give you the unedited version of that whole entire interview, plus our post-discussion after the interview, all for you here in the next 45 minutes. So keep it locked to the Line 90.7 FM for yours truly, your friendly neighborhood annihilator, and Dr. Christian Brady of the Schreyer Honors College.
My guest this week is Dr. Christian Brady. Dr. Christian Brady is the Dean of the Schreyer Honors College at Penn State University. He's also an Associate Professor of Classics and Ancient Mediterranean Studies and Jewish Studies at Penn State. Dr. Brady, welcome to Inside Academia.
Thank you, Andy. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to talk to you today about, first, what it's like to be a dean and what exactly is the mission and role of an honors college in places like Penn State, what I typically like to refer to as big box colleges. First, let me just ask you a very direct question. You came here from Tulane University. You're probably one of the more younger deans that are out there in the collegiate world. What's it like to be a collegiate dean at Penn State University?
Well, first of all, it's a very welcoming place. Just finishing my fifth year, it hardly feels like it. And it is true. I'm a good bit younger than most of my colleagues here and elsewhere. I won't say how much younger. But everybody has been incredibly welcoming. It is an incredibly collaborative place, Penn State. You might have to unpack for me your big box descriptor at some point. But collaborative is the key word for honors programs and colleges. We don't have faculty of our own in 9 times out of 10. And so all the courses that are offered, the things that we do are by collaboration, the goodwill and good graces of the departments and the faculty willing to offer their time.
All right. And then let's talk a little bit about the Honors College. In any given university where there is an Honors College, it's typically characterized usually by small classes and interactive environments for students both within and outside of the classroom. At Penn State University, they live in the same residence hall, which is also common to many other schools, and they really have that real classical sort of traditional university experience where they get to have bull sessions with one another, and they get to experience what it really is like to be in a colloquial style setting, which normally anymore isn't really common until you get to the graduate level. Many students in universities these days seem to not have that experience unless they're in an honors college. So my question to you is, to what extent is that the case with respect to the Schreyer Honors Program at Penn State? And how could that sort of experience be expanded for the rest of the students that aren't in that type of a program?
Well, I would say, first of all, most of our students at Penn State and other large universities do have smaller class size and opportunities. It's not as the idea of several hundred person lectures and things. We certainly have them. There are only, however, less than a dozen such courses at University Park at Penn State for the entire university. So the image of a large, impersonal college experience at a major university is not really one that's grounded terribly well in reality. Our students do benefit from having smaller class sizes in their honors courses. There are no more than 24 students there, and they get a faculty advisor from day one, which is important in terms of helping the students get a good sense from the faculty directly of the field that they're interested in going into. Now, on the other hand, The staff advisors are actually the ones who often know the details about meeting all your general education requirements and the ins and outs. And I admit, as a faculty member, we're often unaware of some of those more bureaucratic type of offerings. And so, in fact, for us at the Shire Honors College, we have good collaborative relationships between the full-time staff advisors and our faculty, who are really in the role of a mentor. So with the Shire Honors College at Penn State, I can state it short and succinctly. Actually, we're in our recruitment session. We've made our offers to our students. We had over 2,900 applications for 300 spots this year. And the way we put it is that the Shire Honors College provides you with the opportunity to have the best of both worlds. A top-notch Research One institution that is Penn State, all the resources that come with it, major lab space, major grants, the programs you can be a part of, but the small, intimate, collegiate experience that you usually associate with a small liberal arts college.
Looking at the program academically, if, as you may know, when you typically go to a classical liberal arts college, the core curriculum from freshman year through senior year is very comprehensive, and it's very structured in the sense that they start you out learning canonical things from day one all the way up until the very end of the very fourth year, or the fifth year, as it is in some cases. To what extent is there that sort of comprehensiveness for the honors student at a place like Penn State?
Well, the honors students at Penn State don't take any different courses than the other students in terms of what is being offered. There will be honors sections of the regular courses. Penn State University is actually fairly strong in terms of having a core curriculum offer, these general education requirements, whether you're an engineering student, science student, or a philosophy major, for example, in liberal arts. You still have those core gen eds that have to be taken. There are very few honors programs, and frankly, very few liberal arts colleges anymore, that have a lockstep curriculum all the way through. University of Texas Plan 2 is about the only one I know of in terms of an honors program that has such a core course that everybody has to take.
Okay, well, the reason I ask is because I've interviewed a number of other people, and one of whom was the American Council of Trustees and Alumni. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have a website called whatwillthelearn.com in which they looked at several universities, public universities, state universities, and so on. And they identified about seven core areas of what they feel would be necessary for a college graduate, to achieve a level of proficiency in things like economics, U.S. history, and so on and so forth, mathematics, mm-hmm. composition, and literature, et cetera. And most of the schools that they've looked at said that they usually, on average, have anywhere between two and five requirements met, meaning that they actually require the students to take a specific course in U.S. history, for example, or mm-hmm. in economics. At Penn State, they graded it as having three or four out of the seven. For example, there's a U.S. cultures requirement, but not a U.S. history requirement. And then within that, you get to choose from many, many courses, some of which are sort of obscure or on the periphery. And consequently, that leads to a student potentially graduating with huge gaps in their knowledge and not necessarily being proficient in either civics or, for example, in economics or core things that we would expect a college graduate to be, you know, a productive citizen and everything in a modern world to know. So I would imagine that an honor student would be the exception to that, would have some comprehensive degree of all of those areas. Can you speak to that?
Well, I can't speak specifically to this, what will they learn? I don't know the site. But our honors students have the same expectations as a regular Penn State student. There's only one course we require from them, which is English 30, an honors version of English, and they all must do their thesis. I think the difficulty, Andy, is that there are lots of different constituents and groups out there saying, we know what is a core curriculum that students must know when they graduate. If you're an engineering student, there is an accrediting body that says, here are the core things you need to know for engineering. If you're a business student, here are core things you need to know about business. In our own disciplines, within liberal arts, for example, in my field, we would say, okay, here are the things we believe you must know in Jewish studies. Right. Those are a lot of tensions pulling in a lot of different directions. I think the core general education requirements that are required of our students at Penn State mean that the vast majority of our students graduate with a good broad base of understanding with the opportunity to concentrate in the specific areas that they're most interested in.
So basically you're saying that the course requirements are for pretty much the same. Students can take from the same pool of options as any other student. The only difference is that each and every honors labeled course is perhaps more accelerated and is taught by a designated professor that is understanding it to be an honors course.
Correct. All honors courses are taught by tenured faculty or on occasion some distinguished guest visitors. Those honors courses, though, I will add this, are not particularly accelerated per se. And they're not just harder for the sake of being harder. I'll give my own example. If I'm teaching Intro to Hebrew Bible, ordinarily we'll have a textbook and we'll read the biblical text. There's a lot of material to get through, a couple thousand years worth of history there. When I'm doing an honors course, we'll look into secondary literature. We'll start reading what other scholars have said about the material. We might look at historical interpretation of texts, and the students will be asked to do some of their own critical thinking and writing to go along with that in that smaller class environment. Mathematics, for example, honors math is much more theoretical as opposed to a more practical side of math. So those are the kind of distinctions you get by discipline.
Approximately how many students are in the Shire Honors Program at Penn State?
We have just under 1,700 students. We take in 300 students as first-year scholars coming in as freshmen. Then we also have the Gateway, where students can come in through their departments and as early as their sophomore year, but no later than having four semesters, which, unless you're architecture, that means you come in as a junior. And last year, we took in 365 students as Gateway scholars.
Now, out of the... And by the way, I thought the number was actually larger than that, but they've got less than 2,000 students that are honors students out of 40,000 plus graduates at a university such as Penn State. My question would be then, if how many of those students are getting educated or instructed by tenured professors or just professors as opposed to graduate students? Virtually all of them, or
all of our Penn State students are getting instructed by full-time faculty. Yes, there are some, and our honors students, even English 30, because we have so many sections of that, there will be instructors and some graduate students. But I think you'd be very hard pressed. You'd have to work really hard as a Penn State student to graduate without having a regular professor or faculty member instructing you. It is a relatively small number of students that we have, but.
Here's why I asked that question. I've spoken to a number of graduate students or past grad students as well as some current ones in departments like philosophy or comparative literature, for example. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that what they expressed to me, the sentiment they expressed, is that there seems to be lacking a middle class of professors. That is to say, a younger professor, such as perhaps younger than yourself, and who makes maybe $40,000 or $50,000 a year but has some considerable degree of expertise within the area they're teaching. And rather what I found was that you had a grad student that had a particular focus working for his or her PhD, and as part of the teaching assistantship or fellowship that they're getting paid, they end up teaching an area that is relatively outside of their expertise. So, for example, if the person is pursuing a PhD in philosophy, they're expected to teach a course that's maybe in philosophy of law. But their particular focus and that they're pursuing their PhD for has nothing to do with law or legal philosophy at all. It has to do with another area of philosophy. But that person is being burdened to teach that course, and as a result, they're more or less learning as they go. And so even though they may do the best job as possible, the student, of course, is not getting that material instructed from an expert in the field. And I was wondering if – I don't know how widespread that is to most students, but I was wondering if that's an exception among honor students as opposed to your run-of-the-mill non-honor student.
Well, again, Andy, I can't speak specifically to the situation you describe. It's not one that I'm familiar with here at Penn State. We certainly have graduate students who teach courses. I have a grad assistant, for example. I would be highly surprised to find a graduate student teaching a course outside of their bailiwick. What ordinarily would happen is the graduate students are asked to teach a more general curriculum course. And if anything, when I hear complaints from grad students, they're saying, look, I'm doing all my research in this Iron Age Israel excavations. I want to teach a course on that. And, of course, that's, you know, undergraduates aren't going to be taking those courses. So that kind of niche description is, I'm not saying it never happens. I've certainly not heard of it happening, though. I think it's a little bit of a straw man.
Okay, because I'm drawing on testimony and sentiment that has been expressed
sure.
from other people, and I would hope that would not be happening in an honors college, and I'm presuming it most likely does not.
As I said, our honors students, if it's an honors course, it has to be taught by a regular faculty member, the only exception being in English 30, where it's mostly instructors, folks who are fixed-term faculty who have been around for a time with the occasional graduate student. All of those faculty are vetted by our office, so we maintain the high quality of the offering that's there. But okay. I think, yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I wanted to ask you quickly a question about social media. I understand you're a big advocate of the use of social media in the class. Can you just quickly describe what exactly you folks do in this modern age of
sure.
technology that we have today?
Well, there's sort of two categories. You mentioned in the class, I don't spend as much time in the classroom now as I'd like. In that context, we're using things like blogging for, instead of submitting papers, our students are submitting their writing in blogs, and they're commenting on one another. We use such services as Delicious Tags to highlight articles and things so everybody can share them. In my administrative role, I have a Twitter account. I have a couple of blogs that I use. I do podcast interviews with alumni and distinguished visitors. And so we use all of that to push the media out there, to speak directly to our students and the parents of our students. On the blog, I posted recently about the budget situation and what impact that will or won't be having on the Honors College programming. So I think it's very important. It's very reactive. Of course, Facebook as well. Not only do I have a personal account, but we have a college account and so on.
Okay, and how interactive is this within each and every class for the honors classes in particular?
It depends. You know, the College of Liberal Arts, there are an awful lot of faculty who are engaging in use of social media in the classroom. Christopher Long is our new associate dean in the College of Liberal Arts and a professor of philosophy. It would be a great person for you to talk with about a number of your questions, including use of social media. So the blogging platform is being used extensively. Podcasting, my brother who has been teaching supply chain down at Harrisburg, Capital College in Harrisburg, has his students do a podcast interview of a business leader in the area, and that's one of their assignments. It's a collaborative project. It gets them engaging directly with people in the field. So there's a lot that's going on around the university, and Penn State actually is doing very well. I'll note, actually, I just got an email that our world campus, Penn State's world campus, it was just announced today, was ranked number one in the nation.
Excellent, excellent. Let me ask you just one follow-up question to the social media. Previously, we interviewed Mark Bauerlein, the author of The Dumbest Generation, How Digital Media is Stupefying Young Americans. And basically, his argument, his thesis in that book was to say that so many young people, high school, early college age, are using a lot of this social media and what he calls digital media, digital technology, but they're not engaging in intelligent media. They're constantly, it's a 24/7 cycle, nonstop, of texting and you know, Facebooking and tweeting, but not necessarily engaging in intelligent topics with it. How do you see digital media in so far as an aid to college curriculum? Are people using it and embracing it to engage intelligent subjects outside of the classroom, or is that digital trend more of a hindrance rather than a help to the educational experience?
I actually saw that you had that interview. I don't know his book. I can point to a couple others that would say the opposite. The question is, were pen and paper a hindrance to learning? In certain cultures, and there's actually a blogger who drew this out, certain cultures where the focus was on memorization, rote memorization, saw the use of writing materials, even fundamental pen and paper, as detrimental to learning and tradition. The printing press was roundly criticized. I see students engaging all the time and good, solid debate and discussion through the blogs, even through Twitter. Look at something like onwardstate.com mm-hmm. that was started by Penn Staters. There's a lot of great discussion that's going on there and engagement. It is simply a tool. All of these things are simply tools. Some tools can be more distracting than others, but they themselves are not inherently drawing down our students.
The question is, are they using those tools much to their intellectual enrichment, more so than to their distraction? That's the question. In your assessment,
right?
In
my assessment is no more or less than print media. Right? Print media gives us Playboy,
sure,
and it gives us the Society of Biblical Literature's Journal. You know,
right.
it's a choice that people make, and in general. If we're just sitting home on the weekend, we're more likely, most of us, to pick up the comics or the sports page than a philosophical treatise. And so it is when we go on the web, an average person is as likely to while away time looking on Facebook as they are reading up on exactly what's going on with the nuclear reactors in Japan.
Right.
But again, these are mere tools. They're neutral. And so I think to say that social media is dumbing down this generation is a fallacy. They're just tools.
Okay. Well, I'd like to talk to you further about this on another occasion, Dr.
Brady.
Happy but
to.
We're out of time, so I want to thank you again, Dr. Christian Brady of the Penn State Schreyer Honors College. Thank you for joining us today as we take you for a look behind the ivory curtain.
You're listening to Radio Free Penn State.
We want information.
The Lion 90.7 FM is celebrating 15 years on the air in Happy Valley and 60 years of student radio at Penn State. Now you can celebrate with us and show your support with a Lion 90.7 FM commemorative t-shirt, available exclusively at the student bookstore, The Big Blue on the Corner, located at 330 East College Avenue. The commemorative shirts are only $8.99, and 100% of the proceeds go toward the Student Radio Alumni Endowment, thanks to the generosity of the student bookstore. Pick up your shirt today and keep the tradition of college radio alive at Penn State.
The Lion 90.7 FM thanks the long-time, dedicated, and ongoing support of local attorney Andrew Shubin. Attorney Shubin provides defense for DUIs, underage drinking, and criminal charges. Now at his new location at 328 South Atherton Street in State College, Attorney Shubin can be reached at 814-867-3115 or by emailing info@statecollegelaw.com. We at The Lion 90.7 thank Andrew Shubin for over a decade of support.
The Lion 90.7 FM is sponsored in part by Leitner Electronics Incorporated. Leitner Electronics offers broadcast, audio-video, computer networking, security, maintenance, and other professional electronic services. Located in central Pennsylvania, Leitner Electronics Incorporated can be reached at 866-239-3888. Leitner can also be visited online at www.leitnerelectronics.com.
Hi, this is David Horowitz, and you're listening to Radio Free Penn State on the Lion, 90.7 FM, WKPS State College.
All right, now we're going to continue with our discussion with Dean of the Schreyer Honors College here at Penn State, Dr. Christian Brady. This is our post-interview follow-up discussion.
That's perfect. I really want to thank you for taking time out of your day. I'm probably holding you over in your dinner
hour. Yeah, but you're very welcome. It's I'm glad to see it what you're doing. It's there are a lot of important issues out there. I sense that there may be some shibboleths that you're viewing. I'm not too sure about it. I think that the question about graduate students, for example, I think some of these issues get expanded in a way that aren't as realistic as they may seem. So,
well, I spoke to, in fact, the anecdote I brought up with you was incidentally one that I had just learned about literally a few hours ago. I was speaking to somebody over lunch, and they were sharing that particular story with me, and they were telling me in philosophy, were telling me he not only gave me his personal experience of that account, but he told me he knew of at least three other people, fellow grad students within his department, that were in a similar predicament where they were being expected to give, well, the one was teaching an ethics of environmental law or ethics of environmentalism outside of that person's area of philosophy. Mm-hmm. Another person was doing something else, again, far outside of their...
That's the question, Andy, is how far
out
it is.
I don't know how widespread that phenomenon is. And I don't want to suggest that it's happening everywhere. But I do think that if I'm hearing it from two, three different departments, it's certainly a matter of concern. And I think it's a legitimate question.
I don't know if it's necessarily a matter of concern. Context it makes a big difference. So the ethics of environmentalism, for example, I would imagine there are actually probably a lot of philosophy departments which would say that that knowing that discussion all around the debate is something fundamental that every graduate of their program should know. And so teaching this course, even if they are actually doing their research, and our research is for a doctorate is always in a narrow niche someplace else, right? I have in fact never taught a course, an entire course, just on what my publication area is, because it's just too narrow. So, I'm not doubting in the least the testimony you're getting from these folks, and that they were complaining that they had to teach a course on the ethics of environmentalism. But it may be that that was viewed as a larger part of their training and education, and not considered some far out fringe aspect unrelated to their degree.
Well, for example, if I were to take a course having to do with Jewish studies or Hebrew biblical studies or whatnot, I would imagine that if I took that course with you, you would be able to cite for me what are all the major canonical pieces of literature to that area of study that have appeared in the last 50 to 100 years. And then this person confesses to me, you know, listen, I'm taking a basic text and I'm creating a lesson plan, and I can't even tell you what the major canonical pieces of literature there are to this particular area. And as a result, I have to be cautious when I'm grading students too critically, because if they come into my office and they expect me to justify why I gave them a C or a B, I then have to really demonstrate mastery of that material in order to tell them this is where you didn't do this or do that. But if I don't know that myself, it's easier for me to just give them an A or a B rather than a C. And then that does no real service to the student nor the person teaching it.
The question is still, is this an area that they are supposed to have a certain amount of familiarity with? So, for example, when I was trained solely in ancient Judaism and the basic core of these things. When I got to Tulane University, my position involved being director of Jewish studies. I was basically the only person in Jewish studies, and I had to teach an intro course. Well, I had taken a couple of intro courses, and so I had a broad general knowledge. Modernism is not my thing, but it's wholly appropriate that I know it well enough to be able to teach it. And it would seem to me, not knowing the whole context, not to be defending people the context would be a big issue for me as to whether or not this is simply part of their training and their development as a professor of philosophy. Because when they get out, they're going to have to teach those courses, right? And especially more and more, there are very few niche positions available. Most PhDs are going to be getting jobs at schools where they're going to have to teach everything from A to Z in their discipline. And it's better that they get the experience now than later. There's always a backup. That is, there are faculty who are there to be involved. So it's one of the good things, you know, one of the things that might be useful for your listeners is to reach out to someone like a Chris Long, for example, but a head of a department, or I should say the person who's in charge of the graduate program in a department, and in a very informational way, ask, you know, what is your philosophy behind how you train your grad students and what courses you put them in? Mm-hmm. That'd be a discussion I'd like to hear too, because it's... Yeah. I have not had the responsibility of directing students.
That's kind of like the sentiment I've been getting from some people, is that you may have a handful or a few well-endowed chairs because, you know, some donor puts up private money and you have a chairmanship of some kind for somebody, and that professor and that, or that authority in whatever field, is well off with that endowment. But then you have so many of these grad students that are on these stipends and or assistantships, rather, and fellowships, and they're teaching these courses. In many cases, they're somewhat outside of their specific area. I mean, I knew a woman who was here in comparative literature, for example, and her background was, she was fluent in Hungarian and Romanian, and she also had spoken French only because she studied that as a foreign language. But she was native to both Hungarian and Romanian, having come from that part of the world. And when she came here to study and also to teach comparative literature in English, the Department of Comparative Literature, being together with the foreign languages there, they ended up asking her to teach French, even though French was her weakest of the four languages that she spoke. and was really far outside of her expertise or her field of study of comparative lit, even though she was familiar with French literature to some extent and so on. And she said, you know, this is not why I came here. And then she ended up doing something completely different, got a job at the university, not even pursuing anything with comparative lit or foreign language or anything. Only reason I bring that up is it was a different example of a different department. And I don't mean to kind of chew your ear off with this sort of thing. I bring it up to you because when I hear stories like that, I have to imagine that honor students are not getting that experience. They're probably being taught by qualified professors who are experts in their field. And I was wondering, how can we extend that experience to the broader student population?
And I'd be happy to talk more on it because one aspect of honors education that's extremely important to me is that we be 11 through the entire university, that the things that we try out and are able to do, we can be a kind of incubator, try these things out. If they work, extend them to the university. There are the questions of scale, of course. So when you have somebody like a Richard Alley, this famous professor over in EMS, I believe he teaches a couple of a course to hundreds of students, and so you've got his expertise, you have him there. But because it's such a large class, you of course have grad assistants to do the sections and so on. You've got a balance. Unless we're going to go to a school that only has 600 students per incoming class, you've got to figure out a way to balance this properly. We certainly have to work very hard at making sure our graduate students are properly trained, that they have the appropriate language skills, for example. A lot of international students coming in to do graduate work. It's something that I know Penn State takes very seriously. Hank Foley is our dean of the graduate school and vice provost for research. Another good person to talk to, formerly dean of the College of Information Science and Technology. And those are programs that we put in place. And so for the Honors College, certainly our students, the way, by the way, all the honors courses that are on the books, basically everything there's a gen ed for, there's an honors version for that. And as I said, those courses are taught by regular faculty, full-time folks, tenured researching faculty. And then, as I said, once any Penn Stater gets into their major, with very, very, very few exceptions, as in you can count them on one hand, I think accounting and business being one of them, every Penn State student is now into classes that are under 40, if not under 30. And so for the honors curriculum, when they get to that stage...
You mean in the honors college?
No, I'm talking about for Penn State as a whole. Once you get into your major, the vast majority of courses a student is taking, once they get beyond the gen eds, they're small classes. And so for honors students, say in Jewish studies, where we only have, I think, 14 majors as a whole throughout the entire university or University Park, they're not going to have a big enough cohort to have just an honors section of an upper-level Jewish studies course.
I see.
So we use something called honors option. So if I'm teaching Dead Sea Scrolls, very niche course, I might have two or three honors students in it. I will contract with the students, those students, and we'll do some additional work. They'll do some additional readings and tutorials to go along with it.
So they get honors credit for that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right.
Well, I didn't mean to, surprise you or spring any of this on you ask you to account for things that are outside of your department or your college, rather. I brought these issues up because I wanted to gauge to what extent this was perhaps not the case in an honors college and explore ways that we could extend the honors experience to the better part of the student population, because there really is a lot to be said for the benefits of an honors program. And it seems like your average run-of-the-mill student coming in this sort of mass higher education isn't getting that kind of experience. And that's a shame because that, college should be that sort of experience. I would agree.
Well, and again, there two things I would say. One is have to really get a good sense of what is the average college experience at a university the size of Penn State, which I think does have more. I know it has as much engagement for a non-honors student as they desire. The second thing is an honors experience is not just about those honors courses. And again, one aspect of it that I think that is being extended and that everybody here is trying hard to do for the undergraduates is the research aspect of it. So our students in science and engineering, our honors students, from day one, if they want, they're in labs. Now, it's not simply that they're in the research labs doing research because they're honors students, but they're the students who are out there saying, look, I really want to do this. They show the initiative, and they're in there. And consequently, any Penn Stater who's showing that initiative, by and large, space available, they're there. Mm-hmm. And that space available size, it comes back to the bigger question, which is, so long as we're going to have 40,000 undergraduates at University Park, there's going to have to be trade-offs. And we simply have to try and figure what is the, not the most efficient means, but the best means of educating these students in an efficient manner. I hope you get this, the flip there in those two things. And I truly think that that those in charge of these aspects are really trying to consider those issues. I hope, by the way, in the recorded portion, I made it, I hope it was implicitly clear, because I didn't state it categorically, that, you know, where these aren't my areas, I'm not trying to speak with any sort of authority, and I hope your listeners will understand that.
And I'll be sure to include that in my synopsis, in my write-up, that you're not speaking for anything outside of your area, and that we're trying to, as I said, gauge the honors experience and contrast that to the rest, and trying to find whatever the right balance would be so as to be able to extend that experience. And like I've always said, I've said this many times in previous interviews and on the radio as well, that, you know, there's a bargain in all of this where the student has to live up to, they have to work hard, no matter whether they're honor students or not. And unfortunately, many students don't. And I see a vicious cycle in which students kind of get by with a sort of degree of minimalism on the part. They only want to know what's on the test, and they want to get by. And I can imagine as a professor, as a teacher, that's not rewarding or fulfilling to you as a teacher if your students aren't asking intelligent questions, they're not engaging the material, and they're just going through the motions like zombies, and they're just trying to find out what's on the test. And so consequently, it kind of tunes you out as a teacher too, right?
Well, you're absolutely right that as the students have to take initiative, and that's why I think our gateway is so important, because so long as a student is willing to work hard, make the effort and make the grade, then there's an opportunity for anybody to come into the honors program and to do that. And I think we do a pretty, we Penn State do a pretty good job of trying to enable it. But, you know, there are lots of students who want the credentials and to be done with it. And frankly, there are lots of students, we've gone through our application process and sent out our offers. There are a lot of students we can tell in the application, they simply want honors. They want to be able to have it on their CV. Again, something we didn't talk about, I didn't even mention our mission, which is to achieve academic excellence with integrity, build a global perspective, and create opportunities for leadership and civic engagement. The Schreyer Honors College is not just, here are the kids with the top grades and top scores. It's one of the reasons why we're as small as we are, is because it's a holistic package, and it's a holistic review that we do.
That's what I was alluding to when I brought up the comprehensiveness of curriculum from start to finish. I was alluding to that holistic idea, but I was using a very specific example in which, like, for example, I had a friend of mine that went to St. John's in Annapolis, Maryland.
Oh, that's an entirely different kettle of fish.
Right, and that's where I brought up that example from, where they started out freshman year with the ancient studies, Greek, Latin. Well, they were learning the language.
It's a great works curriculum. It is extremely rare. I mean, this is why you had mentioned this as kind of a model, and I hope I didn't sound too chastising, but it's extremely rare to have a liberal arts college experience like that. Lehigh, Colgate, any of those, they're the same model that we have at Penn State, except they don't have engineering, they don't have hardcore science, and so forth. St. John's is very rare.
If we can set up two extremes, where the St. John's in Annapolis is the one extreme, okay, then could you make the argument that maybe the opposite extreme is one in which we broaden out our requirements or dilute the requirements so broadly that there is not enough of a core focus?
I would take the opposite extreme would be an engineering school, for example, although it could be a business school. You know, it's not going to be liberal arts just because the nature of liberal arts. And I won't name names, but you could pick an engineering program where they enter into engineering. They have to take a speech class and they have to take a writing class only because the accreditation body require it. Mm-hmm. But everything else they do is math and engineering and everything else. So they may come out being tremendous engineers, but they have – they. any other skills they have in other areas and knowledge they have is solely because the student has taken the initiative to do it. I would say that's the other end as opposed to what we have at Penn State. Okay. And I heard you discuss this in one of your other podcasts, the fact that with I apologize, I can't even remember what all of our gen ed requirements are, but the U.S. requirements
versus
so forth.
U.S. history.
Yeah, and
well, the example that when I interviewed the president of ACTA, the thing they brought up there was to say that with respect to U.S. cultures as opposed to U.S. history, you get to choose from so many different courses, many of which are narrow in scope.
Right.
And so you could take, and I'm drawing a blank for an example. I had a couple before where you could take some niche course, mm-hmm. but relatively niche, and suffice that as a meeting of the requirement.
Yeah.
And consequently, you will have met the U.S. cultures requirement. So you could end up graduating from college with a degree and having little or no understanding of U.S. history. Now, if you didn't get a good solid background of that in high school, then you're 22, 23. You got a bachelor's looking to go to grad school. And at this point, everybody expects you to know these sort of things. But you could end up graduating with a 4.0 GPA and you don't know.
I would say a basic understanding of U.S. history, civics, and politics is not the role of a college education. You should have that in high school. And to criticize universities for not doing what our high schools ought to be doing is, I think, barking up
unfair.
The wrong tree. Yeah, it's not so much unfair. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I do feel it's unfair because
faculty say that.
We do in many areas have to pick up the slack. I mean, we have this very bizarre tension going on, and I see it in the Honors College. We've got kids coming in with 56 AP credits. They basically have already started college work or what is sold to them as college work in their junior year in high school. And so if you're in a privileged context, yeah, you've gotten all of that in high school. You've gotten U.S. history and all the rest of it, and you've if you haven't gotten it, it's not because it wasn't there. I mean, most of the high schools do require it on some level. But that's if you're in an appropriate and relatively well-supported high school. That's not the same if you're in a non-magnet school in Philadelphia, for example.
Right. Many unfortunately don't get that experience. Well, you're right to point out that it's not fair to put the whole onus on the universities because they're bringing in students that are very spotty in terms, they're inconsistent in terms of one high school, they may be brilliant, another one, another area of a suburb or an urban area, they're very deficient in terms of what they come in knowing. But then the question is maybe should there be either an entrance proficiency exam that covers those core areas and or also a conclusive proficiency exam when you graduate? So in addition to GPA and grades and major, we have a metric by which to determine what did you or did you not learn in the 4 years that you were here? Mm-hmm. What did you know coming in? What did you learn since you came in? I would think those are all things that as educators we would be concerned with, especially if we all believe that this higher education is such an integral portion of society.
And I think that, and here we're getting out of my area of expertise, but I certainly think that is a concern. I think that there are those who are concerned, and as flawed as almost everybody, conservative and liberal, feel that the I just blanked on the name of the Education Act, the Bush
No Child Left Behind
program. It as much as people argued about it and people across the spectrum find it flawed, people across this political spectrum also appreciated the fact that it was trying to say, look, there's some basic skills, basic knowledge that everybody ought to have, and we want to try and address this in some way. Yeah. I will tell you, in our application process for the Honors College, we do something of the sort in that while Penn State considers SATs for general admission, we don't consider SATs. What we do, though, is we look at the transcript in great detail. And so we look very carefully to see what they've done and have they taken the most challenging courses. Do they have the breadth and the depth and things of that nature? So it is very important. I will, while we're on it ideologically and before we go, I will stick my oar in. It seems a bit ironic, I know, given that I am dean of the Honors College, and really what is considered by many the best Honors College in the nation, and I find that a very humbling fact that I'm sitting in this chair. But we have failed. We have, when much of the United States moved away from an agrarian base, we let our vocational and technological programs go in our high schools. Mm-hmm. And in the same way that we have grade inflation, everybody knows we have grade inflation. There's no controversy there. We have degree inflation. And I think rebuilding, restructuring vocational and technological programs in the high school level mm-hmm. is, and to a certain extent going into community college, not everybody needs to have a bachelor's degree, a four-year degree. Not everybody needs to have an honors degree or a PhD and so forth. But because everybody now is getting the bachelor's, that means you've got to at least have a master's right. to distinguish yourself. And in right. other fields, you have to have a PhD. All that's doing is creating a tremendous amount of debt. And there are lots of really right. good paying jobs that could and should be out there for people with a two-year degree.
I couldn't agree with
but
you
our
more.
System has inflated the degrees such that...
But then why do we, you know, cling on to... And you don't have to answer this or anything, you know, mm-hmm. but I mean, like, why? My question then is, given all that reality, then why do we cling to the idea that the bachelor's degree is the ticket to success? I mean, why don't we go back and rediscover the necessity of all of these things that don't necessarily require a bachelor's degree, especially when it contrasts to the point that traditionally higher education was very much about intellectual enrichment.
I see
so many kids coming through college today, going through the motions, going through the what they're told as the ticket to success, getting their ticket punched, and they don't care to be intellectually enriched. And I don't, and consequently, I don't see a lot of some of their teachers are also very disillusioned in the whole process, and they too are going through some motions. And so, for the amount that students are paying and going into debt for, I think we have a serious problem.
I agree, and I think
and it's
that
mostly outside of an honors college. So,
I think that to be honest, the fault lies with I'll describe it as a free market economy, right? The job market says I could take someone with a 2-year degree. Yeah, they've got all the skills and everything else, but then I've got somebody with a 4-year degree. Well, they must have something more. They've got a 4-year degree. I'll take that person, or an accrediting body. Says, you know, as we develop into this particular kind of engineering or this particular kind of business, we need to make sure they have these skills. And it all becomes a question of marketing, and it becomes a question of the market itself. And in order to compete in that market, and so my point is, you're never going to put the genie back in the bottle. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. How are we going to go and convince a telecom or an engineering company or even a Microsoft that, you know, they could get a 17, 18-year-old who really knows code and is brilliant right. at code, and they're going to do just as good a job for Google as somebody who has a 4 or 6-year degree.
Right.
It happens a little bit out in that space, frankly, but it hardly happens anywhere else, and I don't see how we're going to put that back in the bottle. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly welcome to any ideas, because it is a real problem, and we're regularly counseling students. It is surprising to many people that when students come to me and they're wrestling between they've got a full ride for the University of Maryland and their honors program versus coming to us. They live in Maryland. Mom and Dad are Penn Staters. They've always dreamed of coming to Penn State. There's only so much funding we can offer them. We've offered them an admission. We'd love to have them. And I tell them, frankly, save your money for grad school. If that's the route you're going to take, I can't justify for you.
Sure.
University of Maryland is a good school. Their yeah. honors program is a good honors program. And I think it would be morally wrong of me to try and persuade and bait them to come here knowing they're going to take $15,000, $20,000 worth of debt a year for a program that they're going to get fully funded for at home.
It sounds like really somebody needs to sit down with these high school graduates and really help them strategize and plot out, well, where do you want to end up with this and what's the best yeah. way to go? But the problem is so many kids coming out of high school at age 18, I mean, for crying out loud, they don't even know what they do. And they say, well, let's just push them into the system. And as they go along the way, they'll figure it out as they go along. Well, and then some of them discover, you know, I don't even want to be here at all. I don't even know what I'm doing here.
Well, since I'm not running the zoo, but I'm running my mouth, there's another concept that I think that we should rediscover or borrow from Europe, which is a gap year. I went to Cornell as an undergrad. I started out chemistry pre-med. I quickly decided, realized that wasn't what I wanted to do. But because my heart wasn't in it, my grades weren't great. Cornell sends me a letter saying you might want to rethink the whole higher education thing, and I took a year off. I ended up going back to Cornell and graduating, was on the dean's list and all that kind of stuff once I found my niche. But that year off was invaluable to me. Just as you said, Andy, what 17, 18-year-old really knows what they want to do? Some of them do.
Right.
I had a student my first year here. I met her. She told me she wanted to be an actuarial scientist. I honestly had no idea what that was. She told me. 4 years later, last year, she graduated. She loves her discipline. She knew what it was. She went for it. I think that we need more opportunities. And I won't give you my whole plan if I ran the zoo, because it involves a sort of Peace Corps-like type of program, similar to what the Germans had. But I imagine kids coming out of high school, I'm going to go ahead and tell you. So they get, you know, imagine the kind of draft where you say, okay, look, I don't want to be in the military. Fine. You know, we're going to create what one of my brother's graduate students, when he was teaching in the Air Force, called a Rainbow Force. And instead of using our National Guard for natural disasters and things of that nature, we train up a force that is not a fighting force. They're all about rebuilding and relief and development and so forth. So for 2 years, we either go into military service, and so I'm coming out of a high school. I don't have a ton of academic initiative or desire. I go into the military. I come out with some discipline. I come out with some basic skills. Maybe it's computer skills. Maybe it's mechanical skills. Or I come out and I go and work in community service. I work in hospitals. And when I'm done my 2 years, I've built up some scholarship money. I've built up some skills. I either go in, use that scholarship money, get an education that I now have a much better sense of where I want to go, or I've got some skills. And I can now go get a really good job working for a telecom or working in a manufacturing sector or what have you. But the problem is we've got this huge gap in the middle. Students are either pushed into higher ed because they have to get that degree, as you said, it's their ticket, or they just don't go anywhere. And we've got a lot of joblessness.
Yeah. Right, right.
Without skills.
Well, listen, Dr. Brady.
We took an hour.
No. Listen, I appreciate your candid perspective on this, and you're in a lot of ways you're saying a lot of the things that I've been contemplating, thinking about, and kicking around with a lot of other people. So I really appreciate getting your perspective in a lot of this.
Happy to join you.
All right, that was our candid interview with Dean of the Shriars Honors College here at Penn State, Dr. Christian Brady. That's going to do it for Radio Free Penn State, running overboard for now. But your friendly neighborhood annihilator signing off. We'll be back on Monday. Same beer time, same beer channel, 5 o'clock on The Line, 90.7 FM. Good luck on finals, everybody. Tune in. Keep it locked to The Line. The Sports Blitz is coming up next.
Well, Kathy, I'll tell you.
It's WKPS State College.
What are you waiting for, loser?
The Line, 90.7 FM.
Possible side effects include loss of scalp and penis.